my family since I was a kid. Romanian people love to go into the nature, and Romanian families all have the necessary equipment for it.
Dr. Orbudov goes mountain climbing every weekend with her daughter and her Iranian friends. She has a poetic interpretation of mountain climbing. She believes ascending a mountain brings hope to her heart that there'll be a better tomorrow.
Mountain refreshes you. Clean air and physical activities make you feel good. Now everybody knows how vital it is for people's health, especially for heart and muscles. I love to live in the nature, so every morning I could open the doors of my clinic and see the jungle and trees. I like it very much. Nature is refreshing. In summers, people travel to Romania from countries with hot climate. Every morning at sunrise, you can open the windows and hear all kinds of birds singing. Romania has a long cold winter, but its summers are really beautiful.
Dacă aș vrea să spun în câteva cuvinte cum e să trăiești în Iran, aș spune în felul următor.
It's hard to live in Iran, but to me, of its beauties are worth even bearing more hardship.
Treburile zilnice.
The beauties are related to the culture, to the religion, and to Iranians' attitudes. But it has also lots of difficulties.
Recompensează.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In the United States, President Joe Biden has condemned what he called anti-Semitic protests at many elite universities in the United States. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. And national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. President Joe Biden on Monday, 22nd of April, weighed in on the pro-Palestine demonstrations taking place at elite university campuses in the United States. "I condemn the anti-Semitic protests," Mr. Biden told reporters after an Earth Day event in Northern Virginia on Monday, 22nd of April. "That's why I've set up a program to deal with that. I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians." A reporter cut off the president's sentence before he could finish. More than 100 people have been arrested at Columbia University since pro-Palestine protesters began occupying the grounds last week. And police arrested 45 protesters at Yale University on Monday, 22nd of April, after the demonstrators repeatedly refused to vacate the plaza voluntarily. Protesters outside of New York University's Stern School of Business were also arrested on Monday night. Students at Yale and Columbia universities are calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and demanding their universities divest from companies connected to the Israeli regime. But some Jewish students at Columbia University say many of the chants are anti-Semitic and they're concerned about their own safety. Similar protests have been taking place at other college campuses in the U.S., including at MIT, Boston University, Emerson College, and Tufts University. Other top Democrats, including Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, both of New York, have also criticized the demonstrations. Calls are growing for Columbia University's president, Nemat Minu Shafik, to resign, as Columbia goes fully remote in an effort to de-escalate the situation. The entire Republican Congressional New York delegation called for Shafik's resignation on Monday, 22nd of April, accusing her of failing to keep students safe. "The ongoing situation that has unfolded is a direct symptom of your continued lax enforcement of policy and clear double standards," the lawmakers wrote. "Your failure to enforce the rules on campus has created an environment in which students and outside agitators know that they're able to operate with impunity and without any accountability. While the rot is systematic, the responsibility rests squarely on your shoulders." Republican Representative Mike Lawler of New York, who was just outside of Columbia University on Monday, said, "Everybody has a right to protest. They have the right to voice their opinion. The moment that you turn that into physical assaults or threats against others is the moment that you lose that right." Nemat Minu Shafik testified before Congress for several hours last week, telling Congress, "Anti-Semitism has no place on our campus, and I'm personally committed to doing everything I can to confront it directly." Some Jewish congressional Democrats also went to Columbia's campus to offer their support for Jewish students. They did not echo the calls for Shafik's resignation, but demanded the restoration of order within the university. Addressing his remarks to the university's administrators, Democratic Representative Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey said, "Stop the double talk and start acting now. Discipline harassers. Restore civility on this campus, encourage peaceful, constructive dialogue." President Biden declined on Monday, 22nd of April, to weigh on Shafik's fate. At the same Earth Day event with President Biden, Progressive Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York cited the peaceful student-led protests at Columbia University and other campuses, highlighting how politically sensitive the politics are with respect to the Israeli-Hamas conflict. President Biden also condemned anti-Semitism at protests at university campuses in a written statement on Sunday night. "Silence is complicity," he said. "Even in recent days, when we've seen harassment and calls for violence against Jews, this blatant anti-Semitism is reprehensible and dangerous, and it has absolutely no place on college campuses or anywhere else in our country." Meanwhile, the Israeli regime has continued its near-daily raids on Rafah, a city in southern Gaza Strip, resulting in the deaths of many Palestinian civilians, including many children. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story and tells us more. President Biden on Monday, 22nd of April, said he condemns anti-Semitic protests amid escalating pro-Palestine demonstrations at Columbia University and on other U.S. college campuses. President Biden said, "I condemn the anti-Semitic protests. That's why I set up a program to deal with that. I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians." President Biden was cut off by a journalist before he could complete his sentence. He was then asked if the Columbia University president should resign and replied, "I don't know that." Just before taking questions from reporters, Biden was talking with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, who has been an outspoken voice during the Israel-Hamas war and last month claimed Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. President Biden and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez were together in Virginia for a climate change event to mark Earth Day. The president's comments come as hundreds of students at Columbia University are occupying the center of university campus in protest. Students are being arrested and school president, Minouz Shafik, faces calls for her to resign. The protesters, who include Jewish students, are calling for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip, and for the Biden administration to halt all military aid to Israel. Demonstrations have spread to other campuses in the United States, including New York University, Yale University, and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. The Biden administration denounced the protests on Sunday, calling them blatantly anti-Semitic and saying they were encouraging calls for violence. While every American has the right to peaceful protests, calls for violence and physical intimidation targeting Jewish students in the Jewish community are blatantly anti-Semitic, unconscionable, and dangerous. They have absolutely no place on any college campus or anywhere in the United States, the White House issued a statement.
Hidden Files. Well, it is hard to believe that we are still witnessing this Zionist Holocaust take place against the Palestinians in Gaza. How is it possible that 4% of the population in Gaza has been killed or injured? How is it possible that this is still going on? What happened to the leaders of the world? What happened to international law? These are questions that many people have been asking since the start of this genocide. Well, I'm Marzia Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files. And today, we'll be talking to someone who has spent most of his life working in the field of international law and working with various international human rights organizations. Perhaps he can shed some light on the reasons we are still watching genocide in real time without it being forced to be stopped. But before we talk to our guests, let's take a look at this example of an Orwellian realm of doublethink that we recently saw from U.S. President Joe Biden, which is the root of the problem we're facing encountering this genocide.
What is your red line with Prime Minister Netanyahu? Do you have a red line? For instance, would invasion of Rafah, which you have urged him not to do, would that be a red line?
It is a red line, but I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have. But there's red lines that if it crosses, and you cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead as a consequence of going after. There's other ways to deal, to deal with with the trauma caused by Hamas. And it's like the first time I went over, I sat with them and I sat with a war cabinet. I said, look, don't make the mistake.
Well, as mind-boggling as that is, it is the reality coming out of Washington when dealing with the Israeli regime. Well, I'd like to bring in our guest now who may be able to explain to us how we got here and why has international law failed the people of Palestine.
Alfred Morris de Zayas is an American lawyer, writer, historian, and expert in the field of human rights and international law, a retired high-ranking United Nations official, a peace activist, and since 2012, the United Nations independent expert on the promotion of democratic and equitable international order, also known as Special Rapporteur, appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council. He is a retired senior lawyer with the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and former Secretary of the Human Rights Committee and Chief of the Petitions Section.
Well, welcome to Hidden Files, Alfred Maurice de Zayas. With your experience, perhaps you can explain to us what is happening and why we're seeing this total breakdown in international law. I mean, from a strictly legal sense, which international laws would you say have been violated in Gaza since October, and how would you define these crimes?
Well, the International Court of Justice already, back in 2004, had the opportunity to examine the practice and the legislation in Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And they determined that there were serious violations of the international human rights regime. That entails the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Convention Against Torture, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. Then they also went into international humanitarian law and actions that Israel has done, collective punishment, destruction of private property in occupied territory, etc., which all violates the Hague Conventions of 1907 and, of course, the Geneva Conventions of 1949, and the 1977 protocols. Now, at that time, when we talk about the Gaza war, one of the problems that I detect in the media, primarily the narrative of the mainstream media, is that they focus on the 7th of October, 2023, as if the war had started in 2023, whereas obviously the conflict goes back to the mandate that the Brits had over Palestine, and the Nakba, the catastrophe that fell upon the Palestinians when the Israelis waged war on them in 1947-48, expelled a million of them, devastated their houses and their olive orchards, etc., etc. And ever since 1947-48, it's been an ongoing war against the Palestinians, and always occupation of Palestinian territory, denial of the right of the Palestinians of self-determination.
Well, based on what you said and the various sightings that you've just discussed, Israel is an occupation force and the Palestinians have the right to defend themselves and fight the occupiers. But the reality seems to be something else.
Well, that is the problem with international law, because international law is not self-executing. The International Court of Justice cannot enforce its judgment. It depends on the good faith and the goodwill of the state parties to the statute of the ICJ. And, of course, the rulings of the Security Council, say, take Resolution 242 of 1967. That was after the Six-Day War. Israel is ordered by the Security Council to withdraw its army. Never did. So this is something that goes back nearly 60 years of daily violation of Security Council Resolution 242. When a Security Council resolution is violated, then what usually would happen is that you would have a follow-up resolution imposing sanctions under Article 41. But that's impossible because the United States blocks it. Now, one of the most atrocious abuses of the veto power by the United States, we have just seen it over the last weeks, the United States has blocked not one, but three Security Council resolutions demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. What does that tell you? Considering that a case is pending before the International Court of Justice, considering that on the 26th of January, the International Court of Justice decided not only that it had jurisdiction, but that there was a plausible case of genocide in progress, thereby justifying the issuance of an order, what is called provisional measures. So the International Court of Justice adopts a rather comprehensive list of orders to Israel, which Israel has violated, has completely ignored. So that adds insult to injury.
Well, you've researched about the rights of minorities throughout the world. I mean, is there anything comparable to the Palestinian case in your perspective?
Well, you have to go a bit further back in history. We Europeans and Americans have a legacy of colonialism and imperialism. And when the Brits came to North America, there used to be 10 million indigenous in North America. And by the end of the 19th century, there were only 200,000 left. So more than 90% of the indigenous were wiped out. People tried to excuse it and say, oh, well, they all got sick because of European diseases. No doubt, smallpox and other European diseases probably killed as many as 50%. Of the indigenous population, but the rest of the 50% were wiped out deliberately by U.S. forces that kept pushing them further and further west, slaughtered their buffalo, burnt their crops, burnt their villages, slaughtered the civilians. You have so many. Wounded Knee is one of many, many massacres. And people have written quite a bit about the Wounded Knee. As the case may be, that is an example of the deliberate genocide committed by the American governments, a whole series of American governments under the banner of manifest destiny. So our destiny was to conquer the entire territory, except that according to, you know, the doctrine of discovery, you can only discover territory that is terra nullius, territory that doesn't belong to anybody. But when you come to a territory where 10 million people are already settled and they have cities and villages and irrigation and all sorts of things, and what do? You wipe them out because you want the territory, but you don't want the people. You're so racist that you don't want to incorporate the indigenous population into your society. So, first of all, you push them out. You expel them, and you make treaties with them. They trust you, and then you break all the treaties, one right after the other. So, on occasion, the indigenous decided they're going to fight back. And since they were so comparatively weak militarily, they were then crushed by the military power of the United States. Now, Martin Luther King Jr., everybody knows him, respects him, etc. Everybody pays tribute to him. But how about reading what he actually said in his book, Why We Can't Wait, published in 1964, page 141. Martin Luther King writes, our country was born in genocide. And then he goes on, not to talk about slavery, not to talk about segregation and what the Afro-Americans had to endure. He talks about the extermination of the Algonquins and the Crees and the Cherokees and the Navajos, right, and the Dakotas and Lakotas and Sioux and Hopi, etc., etc. And he complains that because of the, shall we say, narrative that we get in history books, this conquest of the Golden West is a success story. Of course, for the whites. I mean, we stole the entire continent and we massacred the population. And he says, as an Afro-American, this is a disgrace. What kind of morals do we have? Are we at all a Christian country? Do we have a moral compass?
Well, thanks so much. Stay with me, Alfred. We'll be right back right after this. Well, thanks so much for staying with me, Alfred. Continuing our discussion, you know, in your previous books, you've explained that genocides generally occurred with the knowledge of a small number of people. Do you see an analogy with Palestine today, given the comparative silence of Western politicians and media bias?
Well, take the Holocaust. The Nazis bent over backwards to hide what they were doing. I mean, they did not have Auschwitz and Majdanek and Sobibor in Frankfurt or in Hamburg or in Berlin. They had it out in Poland and in Ukraine so that the population would not find out about it. And there were rumors, and as soon as there were rumors, they were denied. And those who were spreading the rumors landed themselves in concentration camps. Because people seem to forget that Dachau was opened not for Jews. Dachau was opened to imprison first the communists, then the socialists, anybody who did not bend to the will of Hitler, and there were plenty of Germans who were not bending to his will, they landed in Buchenwald, they landed in Bergen-Belsen, etc., which were not per se extermination camps. The six extermination camps were all in the east. I mean, Treblinka and Lublin, Majdanek, etc., etc. So that the Germans knew that what they were doing was criminal. What's amazing in comparison to what's going on in Gaza is that it's so public. You can watch it on television. You can click on your internet and you have all of these horrendous pictures of hospitals and schools and UN shelters. We have lost a couple of hundred of UN staffers, victims of the indiscriminate bombardment by Israel. And then there is a mainstream narrative that tells you that the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, is very careful not to hurt civilians, that they only target military objectives, and if they kill civilians, this is collateral damage, it's not intended.
Right, but the Israeli regime itself, I mean, has no qualms about publicly commenting about their genocide, whether it's saying that we're going to wipe them out or Amalek. You talked about the Nazis and trying to hide what they had done, but the Israelis don't try to hide it. Your thoughts about this?
That has a psychological explanation. We Americans, we are educated from very small, in grammar school, in primary, in secondary school, that we are, by definition, the good guys, which of course means that everybody else is the bad guy. So we are educated to believe that we are special, that we are exceptional, that we are the indispensable people. And then you have the phenomenon that you're so convinced, you're such a solipsist, me and me and me, that you fear whatever rival there is. So instead of educating the American people or the Israeli people, or for that matter the French or the Germans, etc., that we're the same as everybody else, that we're all children of God, and that we all share this one little planet of ours, and that we have to live together. Instead of teaching that, we are taught to fear. There is a culture of fear inculcated in every student, in every pupil, whether it be the United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany, Israel. I mean, we are by definition the good ones, and the others are threatening us. So you play with the emotions of the population, and remarkably enough, the masses believe it. That is our problem. The capacity of self-deception of the population is very, very great, and the faculty of self-criticism is totally underdeveloped. You have, of course, brilliant professors, John Mearsheimer, Jeffrey Sachs, Francis Boyle, Richard Falk, Stephen Kinzer, Dan Kovalik, who see very clearly what's going on, and they write very clearly about it. But do they come in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, in CNN? Hardly. The New York Times and Washington Post, for instance, never wants to hear my point of view, and when I send them op-ed articles, they never publish them, because I'm not singing the song that they want to hear. So I don't exist. And some of these great scholars, even including Noam Chomsky, are shoved aside because their analysis doesn't fit the agendas of our military, industrial, financial, digital complex. So everything actually revolves around money. The military industrial complex needs war if it wants to make money. We need to sell arms. And only sell arms if the arms are destroyed in war. You can't sell a new tank if they have an army with several tank battalions and the tanks are still intact, so you can't sell them anymore. So you have to make sure that there's a war so that these tanks, so the Leopard tanks and the Abrams tanks are destroyed, so you sell a couple more. Same thing with planes, same thing with missiles, same thing with drones. The whole thing is a financial scam. It's a way of a perpetuum mobile, of constantly feeding wars. How do we do that? Through propaganda. We do that through instilling in the population this fear that justifies ever higher military budgets.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javidar, guest speaker. Salam alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Well, we talked about, some of the jurisprudential laws related to mosque and performing prayers in the mosque with Sheikh Javid in the previous episodes. And we'd like to continue our discussion along the same line. And here in this program, I'd like to start with this question, Sheikh. You talked about some of the most important mosques in the world of Islam.
Yes.
Which are regarded highly sacred, all right?
Yes.
Such as Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi. If you are a traveler and it is mostly so because from all the corners of the world, Muslims in fact would like to travel and visit Mecca, so they have to go to Saudi Arabia, and whether they are muhrim or not, they'd like to offer the prayings there, right?
Yes.
In Mecca, should they actually offer their prayers in full or partially? Talk about this?
Yeah, this is a very good question, and also a frequently asked question, you know. When it comes to Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi and even the whole city of Mecca and Medina, a traveler is free to offer his four rakat prayers in shortened form or in full form, you know. Mm. They are free to offer their prayers in full or in parts. You know, for example, in shortened form. Or tamam in taqsir, we have the Arabic word, which probably the audience can understand better. And of course, this is the ruling regarding prayer offered in Mecca and Medina. Now, it's not only inside the mosque in Mecca or in Medina that you can choose to offer your prayers either in shortened form or in complete form. Mm-hmm. But in the entire city of Mecca and Medina, you have the option to go either with full prayer or with shortened prayer.
Is there any recommendation, like, as to, for example, the full prayer rather than the shortened one?
Well, there's no special recommendation, because when you offer, probably, that's my assumption. Mm-hmm. When you offer, for example, four rakat prayers, you have more sawab for each rakah of the prayer. And if you offer the shortened prayer, you offer two rakats of prayer, and probably you will gain
more sawab or reward.
So there's a matter of sawab. And
I see. But what about Masjid Kufa and Karbala?
Yeah, Kufa is a place where you have Masjid Kufa, and that's where the commander of faithful Imam Ali alayhi wasalam was martyred. Of course, in Masjid Kufa, you have also the same option. You can choose to offer your prayer in shortened form or in full form, okay? Mm-hmm. Tamam or Qasr.
Right.
And when it comes to Karbala, of course, the doubt, you know, many people doubt as to whether they are allowed to offer their prayers in full or not. Because as a traveler, you have the right to offer your prayers in shortened form wherever you are, as long as you are a traveler.
Mm-hmm.
But in the holy city of Karbala, of course, you are allowed to offer your prayer in full form when you are close to the chamber, to the zarih of Imam Hussain alayhi salatu wasalam. Like, for example, the very place where the tomb is located.
Mm.
Now, you can offer a few meters you can offer your prayers in full, just a few meters, like 20, 13 or 14, 25 meters, according to one, it depends on the scope of that very hall, you know, the hall in which that very room in which the chamber happens to be.
Right.
Now, you can offer your prayer in full in that very place. But of course, as a traveler, you cannot get a chance to offer your prayer in full in that very place, because it's always crowded.
Mm-hmm.
For people who go to Karbala during Arbaeen season, they can never get a chance to offer their prayers in close proximity to that place.
I see. Chamber. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to offering prayers in the mosque and the importance of mosque, basically. Well, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, well, we all know that there needs to be actually mosques in every city or in every region, especially where there are Muslims. And to do so, they need to sometimes change a building into a mosque, right?
Yes.
So what is the process? What are the procedures, basically, of converting a building into a mosque? Should there be a need, actually, for a scholar, a religious scholar, to come and inaugurate, for example, this building, like they used to do, like the officials actually do it?
Yes.
When they want to open up, for example, a shop, they have scissors and ribbons, and they have to, you know, cut that ribbon. So these formalities or the special formula that needs to be pronounced.
Well, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, if you are converting a building into a mosque, you have to recite the formula of, for example, of endowment, waqf, for a piece of, for example, for that building, in order to, in order for it to be changed into a mosque. For example, you can just say that I endow it, for example, that place as masjid for the sake of Allah. And this is the formula, okay? If you say I endow,
simple as that.
Yeah, simple as that, and that becomes a mosque. So when you recite that formula, that's enough, and that place.
And
becomes,
any individual can pronounce it?
Yeah, the owner of that place, not any individual, okay? When you are an owner of that property or land, you can make that, recite that formula, and then you see that place will be treated and ruled as a masjid. Now, if there is, for example, an ownerless place, like a desert, you want to build a mosque there, His Eminence is of the view that if you you built a structure, a building, with the very intention that it is going to be a mosque, previously there is no structure, no building there, and you just and it was an ownerless place, okay?
Right.
So, if you build, you see, when you build a structure with the very intention that it's going to be a mosque, in this case, it's not necessary to recite the formula because you had the very intention from the very beginning that it's going to be a mosque. That's enough. It will be if for example, a person recites a prayer in that place as a mosque, that's enough. And it will be a mosque. There is no need for the recitation of any formula.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Of course, there are lots of questions which are related to this, but we have to actually postpone it to after the break. Stay with us, and we're going to come back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
اللهم صل على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei about offering prayers in the mosque and the rules about the mosque. Well, Sheikh Javid, I asked you a question regarding the formula that you said that needs to be pronounced or recited in order to convert a building or a place into a mosque. But with the modern world and all the technicalities, the legalities, you know, the legal issues to be taken into account.
Yes.
Because you said as soon as the owner of the building or the place says or recites the special formula, that building is called a mosque. I mean, like, it should be treated as a mosque.
Yes, of course.
But don't you think that with these modern legal technologies, they need to, like, put it down in paper and officialize it and, you know, let everybody know, legally speaking, that this is a mosque, so that the heirs, for example, or the other people or the neighbors would know officially that this is a mosque?
That's good to do, but it's not necessary, you know. Uh-huh. As you rightly mentioned, probably if there's no a proper deed, or you see, well, you know, I mean the waqfnama or that very...
The ownership needs to be transferred, right?
Yeah, the certificate is not issued.
Or and the
it's
title.
Not the title, of course, is not issued from an official source.
Right.
Accepting or acknowledging that it has been considered or transferred and changed into, let's say, a mosque, then probably some people might at the end of the day come and claim its ownership.
Mm.
That's why it's important in this time around to for example, go to a notary office and get it registered.
Yes, exactly.
Otherwise, there is such a probability that the heirs might come and claim it.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And appropriate, in fact, the place and,
yeah,
of
course,
or claim, for example, or that would be very bad, in fact.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Sobit. We like to continue our program, but unfortunately, this is that all the time we have for this episode of Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to delve into some of the jurisprudential laws regarding praying in the mosque and the rules about the mosque based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
In the limelight.
Many Palestinian voices have been silenced or marginalized on social media platforms amid the Israeli regime's genocidal war in Gaza. Many of these users see TikTok as a medium to highlight the ongoing genocidal war crimes in the besieged Palestinian territory. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. Discussions about imposing a ban on TikTok, a short-form video platform owned by a Chinese company, have dominated the public discourse in the United States in recent weeks. The attempts to sell the popular application began during the previous U.S. administration headed by Donald Trump. The incumbent government has intensified the same battle. Recently, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill aimed at pressuring TikTok's Chinese developer, ByteDance, to divest from the company's U.S. operations or face expulsion from the United States. President Joe Biden said he would sign the bill if it passes the U.S. Senate as well. The legislation sets a strict timeline, giving ByteDance 6 months to sell off its U.S. assets or risk a ban in the country. However, final approval rests with the Senate and President Biden's signature. Named the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act, it overwhelmingly passed in the U.S. House of Representatives with 352 votes in favor and only 65 votes against. Lawmakers advocating for the measure cited concerns that TikTok could potentially grant the Chinese government access to the private information of American citizens through its highly engaging algorithm. However, the move was slammed by TikTok's vast user base of 170 million Americans, as well as civil liberties groups and digital rights groups, who warned that a ban would impinge upon freedom of speech, as users are using it to amplify their anger and outrage against genocide in Israel's war in Gaza. While the White House and US legislators push for action against the Chinese app, the fate of the bill hangs in the balance within the US Senate. The upper chamber of the US legislature presents a formidable hurdle where the path forward is far from straightforward. The legislation is set to undergo further scrutiny from lawmakers across the American political spectrum, and it is likely to face competition from alternative versions of a ban. In the broader context, amidst discussions of national security and data privacy, advocates for Palestine warn that the move is part of a broader pattern of technology censorship in line with the biggest and most sinister project shared by the US government and the influential Israeli lobby. Many Palestinian voices have been silenced or marginalized on social media platforms amid the Israeli regime's genocidal war in Gaza. Many of these users see TikTok as a medium to highlight the ongoing genocidal war crimes in the besieged Palestinian territory. US lawmakers have expressed apprehension over the potential clandestine control of ByteDance by the Chinese government. Despite denials from the company, accusations persist regarding the sharing of sensitive user data with the Chinese government. In congressional testimony in March, TikTok's chief executive officer Xu Chu refuted such unsubstantiated claims, emphasizing that ByteDance is a private entity independent of Chinese government control. Xu Chu was quoted as saying at the time, "ByteDance is not owned or controlled by the Chinese government. It is a private company." Xu Chu condemned the disappointing legislative action, pledging vigorous defense measures, including legal recourse, to safeguard the app. Citing proactive data protection measures, TikTok remains optimistic about the U.S. Senate vote, highlighting the application's significant economic impact and its extensive user base. The app owners said in a statement recently, TikTok remains hopeful that the US Senate will consider the facts, listen to their constituents, and realize the impact on the economy, 7 million small businesses, and the 170 million Americans who use our service. This process was secret and the bill was jammed through for one reason, it's a ban. However, skepticism prevails among US legislators, with Senator Marco Rubio alleging during a recent hearing on global threats that Chinese companies, including ByteDance, are subject to control by the Chinese government. Senator Marco Rubio underscored concerns regarding TikTok's utilization of advanced artificial intelligence algorithms fueled by American user data, raising apprehensions about privacy breaches and manipulation. In a bid to sever alleged Chinese influence, according to their claims, policymakers advocate for TikTok's sale to a Western entity, positing it as a viable solution, despite the social media platform's repeated denial, emphasizing the Chinese government's minimal stake in ByteDance. The case has been built against it in Washington. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. TikTok boasts of millions of users across the world who are fiercely against the Israeli-American genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza and have been posting videos in support of Palestinians of the Gaza Strip. In a recent report, The Independent cited a TikTok user, Awa, whose profile on the Chinese